Welcome to the first episode of KRWG News This Week for 2022. Happy New Year. I'm Anthony Murnau. It's always nice to be with you. We start this program off by talking about COVID-19 and the pandemic. On Friday, New Mexico state health officials announced over 4,200 new cases of COVID-19 in the state, along with 14 new deaths related to the virus. As of Friday, health officials said there were 539 individuals hospitalized in New Mexico for COVID-19. State health officials in New Mexico also announced that COVID-19 public health orders will remain in effect, including a requirement to wear masks in public spaces and vaccination requirements for some workers. COVID-19 was the topic of KRWG's weekly call-in program, Voice of the Public. Casey Counts talked with Dr. Dolores Gomez, Chief Medical Officer with Memorial Medical Center in Las Cruces, who offered a COVID-19 update and shared her perspective on why we are seeing more flu cases. Here's part of their conversation on Friday.
What would you say is the state of this pandemic as it is today?
I wish I could say things were moving in a good direction, but it almost feels like a Groundhog Day. If you've seen that movie, you feel like you're just living the same thing over and over again. And I think the thing that's a little bit more bleak right now is the fact that with Omicron that you mentioned, it's not kind of pocketing infections like we were seeing with Delta and even the original COVID-19 wild type virus. It is spreading like wildfire. It is not kind of just pocketing in an area. Because it is so infectious, we're seeing a whole lot more of it. And then I think the second thing that's very different than last year as well is we are seeing a lot more flu this year as compared to last year, I think because we were masking a whole lot more. And I think we were even that much more hyper aware of washing our hands. So now you're not just living with a highly infectious virus, more so than any of the previous variants that we've seen, but we have flu on top of that right now. So it's not great news right now.
Well, and obviously during the onset of the pandemic, there were a lot of closures. Schools were closed and businesses were closed. And so there just weren't as many people congregating in settings like that. It was amazing to see what would happen to the flu virus under those circumstances. And so I think, you know, that the conventional wisdom was, well, when we go back to normal life, which we all want to do, we're going to see the flu come back. And we're not hearing great news about the effectiveness of the flu shot this year. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the flu vaccine in general is when we've tried to tout why it's so important with the COVID vaccine and why it is so effective, because if you have any type of vaccine that gives you 90% efficacy, why wouldn't you get it? The flu has never even been close to that. You know, in a good year, maybe you're about 60%. But by and large, a lot of times we're only seeing 30 to 40% effectiveness of the flu. And a lot of that is because last year we didn't see a lot of it. And your vaccine is based for flu based on your year prior's rates and what you saw. So that's why we're seeing kind of that resurgence of flu. And like you said, we're in indoor environments around each other a whole lot more right now than we were last year.
Flu and coronavirus, flu Rona. Are we seeing a lot of cases with people having both viruses at the same time?
We are in the United States overall. We have not seen a lot of that right now, thus far, at least in Doniana County. But we are seeing people with the flu, and maybe within a few weeks they may end up with COVID or vice versa. Again, you know, your immune status gets affected by any infection that you get, and it's going to make you more susceptible to then getting something else on top of that. And again, with where Omicron is and how infectious it is, it's going to be very easy to see those combinations happening.
Another concerning thing that we're seeing this week is the increase in the hospitalization rates among children, and especially children under 5 who are not yet eligible for a vaccine. How are kids doing in Doniana County?
Yeah, so we are seeing more kids admitted. Now, a lot of it isn't just related to COVID. Again, it's kind of for the same reason. A lot of these kids were not exposed to the routine viruses that we see. Bronchiolitis, which is related to RSV or respiratory syncytial virus. So we're seeing that. I think State Department just put out some information that the amount of COVID cases that are being admitted that are pediatric in nature is at about 17%, which is not even close to what we saw at all last year. You know, we were in the single digits from that standpoint for COVID. Here, at least at Memorial, we've had an uptick in the number of kids, and we're actually getting kids that are coming from El Paso because they are full right now for their pediatric volume. So it may not just be what we're getting here, but again, that support that we've been doing over and over from a hospital standpoint, kind of the shifting of patients and getting them the care that they need because other hospitals are full.
Now, in the fall, we were dealing with that Delta surge, and that seemed to not really end before Omicron showed up. What's your sense at this point? Are most of the people who are suffering from coronavirus suffering from the Omicron variant, or are we still battling a Delta surge?
Yeah, so again, the state just put out some information, and they're still saying that Delta is our predominant virus right now in the state. But again, I don't think that that's going to hold true very long. I think our first case of Omicron that was reported was on December 12th. And if you look at kind of nationwide, when the first cases started happening around December 1st, within a month, it became 90% the predominant virus. And so given that we've started to see it here, I am pretty sure that the Omicron is going to become the dominant variant in the state.
Just this week, the New Mexico Department of Health announced that it was implementing revised guidance surrounding isolation and quarantine for COVID-19 based on what the CDC had recommended. And there was a lot of controversy surrounding that initially. And I'm wondering where things have settled for you in terms of the now 5-day quarantine and isolation guidance for certain individuals.
I think I can see where people got very like, you know, why were we doing 10 or 14 and now all of a sudden we're okay with 5. I think the important caveat within all of that is that this is in the patient that is asymptomatic. Obviously the patient that is vaccinated already. And so it's not that we want people to be back and out and about if they are symptomatic. Obviously symptomatic patients are probably have a much higher viral load and they're going to be at greater risk of exposing. You know, what the CDC said was that if you're vaccinated or not, you can do that isolation for 5 days. But then the next 5 days, you would still be required to be masked when you're out and if you return to work or those kinds of things. So it's still a 10-day quarantine of what you want to do. Again, it's a well-fitting mask. I think there's been a lot of information, again, about cloth masks really probably are no longer acceptable. We should be wearing at least a surgical mask if, you know, you've been exposed and those kinds of things. So I get where the concern and controversy were, but we're not going to want sick people out back at work if they've been exposed or if they have COVID.
Yeah, and you mentioned masks and if the effectiveness of the cloth masks that so many of us wore throughout the course of the pandemic that seemed okay for the previous variants, but with the contagious nature of Omicron, it's just not going to do the trick anymore. So, what is the recommendation? What's the best thing to do?
Well, the absolute best thing to do would be able to have an N95 mask on, especially if you're unvaccinated. Now, again, we know that we don't want to go out and get every N95 mask that's available out there for the general public because, again, we still need those for medical personnel as well. But if there's access to that, that would be your absolute best. A procedural type mask is your next best thing. A lot of people are double masking with surgical masks or with a procedural surgical mask and then maybe a cloth covering over that. You want to do everything you do, but the cloth mask by itself probably is not the best. And again, it goes back, how much do you need to be out and about amongst crowds? Not forgetting that a way to help reduce that risk and mitigation of spread is don't be out if you don't need to be.
That was Dr. Dolores Gomez, Chief Medical Officer with Memorial Medical Center in Las Cruces, talking with Casey Counts on Friday's Voice of the Public. You can listen to the entire conversation of this week's program at our website, krwg.org. This week marked the 1-year anniversary of the attack on the U.S. Capitol. On Thursday, President Biden, Vice President Harris, and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi reflected on the events that unfolded on January 6, 2021. During a press conference this week with voting rights advocates, New Mexico U.S. Senator Ben Ray Lujan shared his thoughts on the attack.
1 year ago, January 6, 2021, our democracy bent, but it didn't break. That dark day reminded us how fragile our democracy is. On that day, many heroes stood up to protect America, from the Capitol Police to congressional leadership to everyday Americans. We made it clear that we'll not hide in fear. Rather, that we will rise to the occasion to do the job that we were sent here to do. And that's what I and all of my colleagues did when we returned to the Senate chamber later that night to complete the Electoral College count. America's democracy prevailed. And despite the efforts of insurrectionists and domestic terrorists, Congress fulfilled our constitutional duty to count the Electoral College votes and defend the will of the American people. In his final words to the nation, Congressman John Lewis affirmed that democracy is not a state, it is an act.
This week, in a letter to colleagues, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said that if voting rights legislation is blocked, the Senate will vote on rule changes. Senator Lujan said the attack on the U.S. Capitol last year proved that Congress must pass voting rights legislation.
As Leader Schumer announced this week, we will vote on changing the Senate rules on or before Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Doing so will allow us to send the Freedom to Vote Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, and the Protecting Our Democracy Act to President Biden's desk. With these bills, we will expand voting access and clean up campaign finance laws. We will prevent violations of civil rights at the ballot box and establish stronger guardrails to combat election subversion. Critically, I secured the inclusion of the Native American Voting Rights Act of 2021 in the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Important legislation to ensure equal access to the electoral process for tribes, Native Americans, Alaska Natives, and voters living on tribal lands. Our democracy is at its strongest when every American can participate and make their voice heard. But in too many communities across America, voter suppression efforts are making it harder for Americans to vote, especially for Native Americans, who continue to experience geographic, linguistic, and legal barriers to voting in federal, state, and local elections.
El Paso Congresswoman Veronica Escobar marked the day this week honoring police officers who defended the U.S. Capitol a year ago. She was among members of Congress who were trapped in the gallery as a mob tried to break down the door. KTEP reported this week that the lawmakers organized a lunch for Capitol Police. Representative Escobar said a year after the violent insurrection, she's concerned about the ongoing threat to American democracy.
We are on a real precipice this year. And if Congress doesn't act, then we are certain to lose our democracy. And it's not something that can be regained easily. Free and fair elections are the cornerstone of this democracy.
Congresswoman Escobar also stressed the need to pass federal voting rights legislation. This week, the president and vice president also said voting rights legislation is a top priority. On Friday, NMSU president Dr. John Floros announced his resignation. In a university-wide communication, Floros said NMSU Chancellor Dr. Dan Arvizu decided to restructure his administration to have one leader for both the university and the NMSU system. Floros said he would take a year-long sabbatical. He has served as president at NMSU since 2018. Also on Friday, in a campus-wide email, Chancellor Arvizu stated that Floros would continue to, quote, serve NMSU in an advisory capacity as special assistant to the chancellor through the next 30 days. Arvizu said he would unveil a new organizational chart Monday morning. This month, New Mexico's state legislature is scheduled to meet for a 30-day legislative session focused on the budget. This week, New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham released her budget proposal that called for a $1 billion increase in general fund spending in the next fiscal year. The 14% spending increase aims to improve access to health care, improve public education, and provide additional investments to public safety and child well-being. Okay, let's go now to news from Las Cruces, where a historic moment happened this week. For the first time, all women are serving on the city council. To learn more about this historic event and a recent plastic bag ban ordinance that took effect in the city, I talked to a District 2 Las Cruces City Councilor, Tessa Abeda-Stuvey. Councilor Abeda-Stuvey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your thoughts on this historic moment this week?
It really was a wonderful week to see all of us up on the dais. It's been a long time coming, I think, for a lot of the counselors and for the community. But I am very excited to see all of us serve and to see what we can do over the next 2 years.
More women have been elected to the state legislature in New Mexico, and New Mexico has all women representing them in the U.S. House of Representatives. Why do you think more women are running for office at a local, state, and national level?
That's a great question. I think one of the reasons is that we all have different stories and experiences, lived experiences to show, and that the communities as a whole are also trusting the voices of women to serve and to lead. I know that there are many women now serving that are either single mothers, they are childless, they are from families, and those all are very unique experiences that historically have not been able to be a part of conversations and decision-making in the past, and it really is a missed perspective.
I want to talk with you also about some issues in the city. Recently in Las Cruces, a plastic bag ban ordinance has taken effect. Now, when this ordinance was passed, you were quoted as saying that you see this as an investment for the future. How so?
On average, a plastic bag is only used for about 12 minutes. And after that, some people recycle, some people use it for other options, and a lot of those plastic bags are just placed in our landfills, or oftentimes you see them flying around in the community and adding to litter. I think that as we look at sustainability on different levels, there's big items that we can do and there's small changes that we can make. And this is one of those smaller changes that we can make that end up creating a larger impact over time.
Okay, so according to this ordinance, some retailers and grocers can offer paper bags, which according to this city ordinance, will add a 10-cent cost to consumers. Some have voiced concern about adding extra charges to consumers in Las Cruces, especially those living in poverty or on a fixed income, in a time when prices have risen. Why add cost to consumers at a time when prices have already gone up?
There are a lot of different options for people when they're bringing in their bags, and the city itself is giving out free reusable bags for individuals. And alongside, we do have other exemptions, especially those that are like using WIC, that will not be charged. So there are different types of exceptions with that. And then as we look forward on different items to bring, a lot of retailers already, you see them using different types of either paper bags or, you know, I know at Natural Grocers, they use boxes. So we're already seeing those changes in our community.
There's certainly been a lot of reporting and research on how single-use plastic bag bans have affected the environment. But there's also been some research done on plastic bag bans and if they're really effective. NPR reported in 2019 on one plastic bag ban in a California region where after the bag ban went into place, there was a dramatic rise in purchases of 4-gallon plastic garbage bags. Are you concerned that this ordinance could cause more demand for plastics in our region?
I think that this is one item that we've asked for data on so that we can constantly keep updated on what those effects are long term. And I think we have to do that with any sustainability items and looking at the future with any of our ordinances as what have been the effects and do a review on that. And this would be no different than any other item.
Las Cruces City Councilor Tessa Abeda Stuvey, who represents District 2, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
KRWG Public Media will be bringing you more coverage of the Las Cruces City Council in the near future as we get to know new city councilors. Okay, let's move on to talk about a very important issue in our region, water. You may be familiar with the saying, whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting. That statement may hold true for New Mexico and Texas because the two states are currently in a water dispute. This week on KRWG-TV's Newsmakers, Madison Staten talked with El Paso Manners journalist Danielle Prokop, who has been reporting on the water fight. Here's part of their conversation.
Let's get started with the basics. The state of Texas is alleging they are not receiving their fair share of the Rio Grande. How much water is Texas currently receiving, and how does that actually compare to previous years?
Right, so climate change is drying the Rio Grande because of higher temperatures, that's variable precipitation, and it's changing the way that we use it. In the last 20 years, we've only seen a full allotment south of Elephant Butte five times. So that water is measured in acre feet, and measures of that water mean it's 1 acre of land, 1 foot deep in water, which is 326,000 gallons. So 2021 was a really concerning drought year for southern New Mexico and West Texas. This year, Elephant Butte Irrigation District received 4 inches of Rio Grande water, and El Paso County Improvement Irrigation District saw 13 inches. That's compared to about the 30 or 40 or so allotted in an average year to both areas. So Texas alleges that New Mexico's groundwater pumping, whether that's irrigation or municipal, is removed 3.3 million acre feet over decades, which is tens of thousands per year. That's hundreds of billions of gallons for scale.
Wow, that's crazy. So what treaties and agreements are in place to actually ensure water is correctly allocated across these state lines?
Right. So let's start with treaties, because, of course, the Rio Grande is a binational river. The U.S. and Mexico signed an agreement in 1906, which was called the Rio Grande Convention, which ensures that other than in extreme drought or if there's an accident with the irrigation system, that Mexico will receive 60,000 acre feet, which, again, more than 16 billion gallons. There's also a compact between the states. That's between Colorado, where the headwaters are, New Mexico, and Texas. It was signed off by Congress in 1939, and it lays out how the water is to be shared, distributed, and measured between the states.
So this is years in the making. Can you walk me through the history surrounding this dispute?
You know, disputes started day one. You know, so since Elephant Butte was constructed in 1916, after sort of the imagination of it in 1902, there were 30 years of disputes between the states, Colorado, New Mexico, and Texas, before the compact even came into being. And the compact was supposed to be an agreement between the states and hammered out in a particularly wet decade. And so, as often with other water disputes, it worsened in dry decades. There's been lawsuits of states against irrigation districts, the districts against municipal water companies, and states suing each other. In more recent history, both irrigation districts, so Elephant Butte Irrigation District in southern New Mexico and the El Paso County Water Improvement District Number 1, were in dispute with the Federal Bureau of Reclamation, who helps operate the opening of the dam to release the water downstream. And so they were saying that there was an inconsistent implementation of a method that they were trying to change the way that water was given because of the drought and also hydrology. So both sued, and it looked like there was a huge court fight in between 2006 and 2008. But instead, the parties made agreements, and the federal government hammered out basically this 2008 operating agreement. In 2011, then New Mexico AG, Gary King, sued over this agreement in federal court, saying that the agreement shorted New Mexico water and gave too much to Texas. And then Texas took that to the Supreme Court and filed suit there. The Supreme Court granted leave to Texas to continue a lawsuit, and that's where we've been for the last 8 years, putting the 2011 lawsuit on hold as sort of everyone waits to see how this shakes out.
Mm-hmm. So what has been New Mexico's response to these allegations?
Well, at first, in first oral arguments back in 2013, it was sort of this idea that Colorado has to deliver water to the New Mexico state line. New Mexico said, we only have to deliver water to Elephant Butte. After that, who knows? That argument has really fallen away as litigation has gone on. Since the litigation has gone on, New Mexico has instead filed counterclaims saying that Texas's own pumping of the Hueco Bolson and other Mesilla Bolson, which are those two groundwater aquifers beneath the land that are connected to the Rio Grande, have impacted New Mexico's access to water. So there's a lot up in the air in this case on whose pumping affects whose water.
That was El Paso Matters journalist Danielle Prokop talking with Madison Staten. You can watch the full Newsmakers interview tomorrow morning at 11 on television from KRWG Public Media. And it's online right now at our website, krwg.org, in the local television section, and also on our KRWG News YouTube channel, where you can subscribe and stay updated on local television news programs and reports. This year, New Mexico voters are going to weigh in on a constitutional amendment that could give a major boost to early childhood education and care in the state. To learn more about this constitutional amendment and how early childhood education and care has been impacted during this pandemic, I talked with Engage New Mexico's Executive Director, Lori Martinez, on this week's episode of Fronteras, A Changing America. Here's part of our conversation. Lori, thank you so much for joining us for the program.
Thanks for having me.
This is obviously such an important issue in New Mexico. It has been for a really long time. And the pandemic has made an impact to this issue as well. Do we have an understanding about how COVID-19 has impacted early childhood education and care in the state?
I think it's safe to say we have some. The pandemic isn't over, so the changes aren't over either. But one area that we do know, I think, more about is related to childcare, because during the pandemic, childcare providers were impacted really heavily, not just in New Mexico, but across the country. And we know that in New Mexico, we lost a lot of childcare providers, not just the center-based ones, but in New Mexico, the state allows home childcare providers as well. And so we know that we lost a fair amount of them. We don't know how many more we're going to lose. And the state has been taking steps to retain them and to try and rectify that situation. But we don't know long-term yet what the outcomes of that are going to be.
Okay, now what has the state done to really take action against this issue and help out childcare providers?
Well, one thing that's important for people to know if they don't already is that our state launched a statewide early childhood education and care department. We're one of just a handful of states in the country that have a cabinet level state department focused on early childhood. And so what that did is it took a lot of our early childhood programs that were previously spread out between the public education department and children, youth, and families department, Department of Health, and moved them under the umbrella of one agency. So what that does is it helps streamline services and hopefully in the long term makes them more accessible to families. The other thing that's important to remember is that that department launched during the pandemic. And so by law, it was slated to, you know, to begin on July 1st, but the reality was they were moving before then. And so some of the things they did were putting lots of subsidies into place right away, for example, and working really hard not to be, I think, punitive towards families and providers whose situations changed really rapidly. Because if you remember at the beginning of the pandemic, only essential providers were really working, you know, and the state had a pretty strict definition at first. And so childcare providers were limited to who they could serve at that time too. They could only serve children of essential providers. And so for a lot of early childhood provider or a lot of childcare providers, they had to make really hard decisions about shutting their doors or not. And the state stepped in with subsidies paying differentials, covering parents' co-pays during that time. And so they did a number of things to work to make sure that there was still some supports in place for the childcare providers. And then when the on the national level, when some relief funds started coming down, the state released funds to childcare providers as well. So the most recent large example of that would be in September of this year, I believe it was, the state distributed millions of dollars under, it was called the Childcare Stabilization Grant. And it was to hundreds of providers in the state, both home and childcare providers, to help them stay afloat, essentially. And they were really, really broad grants, so those providers could use them for just about anything.
Yeah, that was around $157 million, I believe, the state released to the childcare industry in the state. I'm just going from data from the Early Childhood Care Department. Yeah. That was released in the fall. But I want to talk with you. Yes. You served on an advisory council for early childhood education and care in this state. You know, what are the conversations that were happening, bringing all the stakeholders together during these meetings? And how do you see things kind of evolving to where there is sort of a structure starting to be in place to really implement some of the changes?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things that the department had to do was figure out a structure, you know, different bureaus, who's going to be handling what. And so, you know, childcare is its own arena, services that fall under the banner of what would be called like early intervention. So home visiting, there's also, you know, the preschool programs, so like pre-K and Head Start. And they're all funded differently. They're all ran differently. So Head Start being a federal program, for example, and pre-K being state-run program. You know, the good news about all of this that happened is that we've known for years what the issues were. So there's a fair amount of consensus on things that needed to happen. We know that there's not enough early childhood providers in general, not just in childcare, but across the board. And early childhood providers don't get paid living wages. And so those are, you know, those are things that people know pretty much across the board. We need to be able to recruit more people into the field so that students understand that early childhood is a viable career option. And we need to pay them a living wage so that they can stay in the field. And really, you know, if we're going to communicate to the public that early childhood is important, which that message has gotten out, that, you know, that's why we're on the brink of this land grant amendment vote. That message has gotten out, but the message that seems to be getting out slower is that we need to pay early childhood providers what they're worth, especially when we see the same kinds of shortages in early childhood that we see in K-12 education. So there has been efforts there to, you know, how do we streamline bringing people into the field? How do we support them once they're there with professional development opportunities? So workforce was obviously a huge area. Another area is just increasing access to early childhood services in general. We know that the return on investment for early childhood is huge, particularly in areas like pre-K, but also early intervention. You know, the return on investment is, it's a foregone conclusion at this point. People understand that. And so that's an amazing thing because that's pretty well understood now in a, like across the board politically. So in a way, that's really helpful for that not to be necessarily a political battle anymore. It's not, the battle isn't whether or not early childhood is important. It's understood that it is. Where the disagreements come into play is then what to focus on, where to focus dollars, what programs to focus on. So another area is increasing access to early childhood education. And then another big area is dealing with the inequities.
So in the midterm elections, New Mexico voters are going to have an opportunity to weigh in on a constitutional amendment that could really change the outcome of how early childhood education is funded and care in our state. Can you kind of share with us what's going to be on the ballot and what's really at stake here?
Sure. Well, this has been years in the making. Actually, it's been, I think, over a decade now. And that's been a push to take 1% of our land grant permanent fund and use it towards early childhood education. And so when voters go to the polls in November, they will have the option to vote on this amendment. So it already passed in the legislature. because the constitutional amendment, the legislature had to pass it first. The governor didn't have to sign off on it because it's not a bill, but then it has to go to the voters. And so the essence of the amendment is essentially recognizing that education begins at birth, and it would allocate about $125 million from the permanent fund every year to the Early Childhood Education and Care Department. And what changed this year is that they added, when it finally passed, they added an element that would include K-12 as well. So now, in addition to that $125 million, there would also be $75 million to the Public Education Department for K-12 education.
Is that move really enough? I know that New Mexico Voices for Children spoke out saying that more funding is even needed because it really doesn't fully address the issue of how many kids are dealing with poverty in New Mexico here, saying that it costs a lot more to help educate a child who is growing up in poverty than a child that has access to a lot of amenities. Can you kind of give us an understanding of why that is?
Education isn't just about who shows up at the door. It's about everything that's happening in that child's life before they walk up to the door of any particular school or their child care provider. And so, you know, we have some of the highest food insecurity rates in the country, particularly with regards to child hunger or child food insecurity. And so, particularly with what we know about early childhood, we know that the brain develops at a tremendous rate during those first 3 years. And so if that child isn't getting everything that they're needing in terms of food, but also consistent care from their providers, safety, all of those things, then it impacts the brain development. And it in turn impacts their ability to learn. And so when we're talking about early childhood, our childhood well-being in general, it's about increasing access to care. It's making sure that kids have responsive care, whether it's at home or in an educational setting, but it's also making sure that kids have their basic needs met. So food, housing. One of the things the pandemic unearthed was that, or made obvious to a point we can't ignore it anymore, is that broadband is not a luxury. Broadband is a necessity, and if families are cut off from broadband, they're cut off from what they need. And so families that live in poverty chronically in poverty don't have access to a lot of those things. And that impacts their child's ability to learn and develop optimally. So no, $125 million a year is not going to take care of all of that. That's intended to address access to early childhood education programs specifically. The state and our local communities and nationally, there needs to be a lot of efforts around child well-being holistically. Access to early childhood education is one way. It's one huge, important way to deal with the effects of poverty, but it's not the only thing.
What are things you think voters need to consider when they go into that booth to check yes or no on that question? What's the long-term vision on this plan?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one thing a question that voters would probably have, which is understandable, is if I vote yes on this, how does that impact me? You know, people want to know, in fact, most people probably don't know that the state has the land grant permanent fund, much less what it is. And, you know, as a taxpayer, most people want to know, is this going to affect my income? So what's important for people to know is that the state does have this land grant permanent education fund. It's one of the largest in the country. And so what the fund grows at a huge rate. So when this campaign to pass the constitutional amendment started over 10 years ago, the fund had $10 billion in it. And today it has over $22 billion in it. So the fund's growing every year at a pretty consistent rate. I think it's 11%, and so, or around 11%. And what the proposal is to take 1% of that and allocate it towards early childhood education and care. And the reason that's important is because one of the many reasons it's important is that people are seeing right now, I think, all these resources going into early childhood, which is long overdue. The challenge with a lot of those funds is that they're non-recurring. So, you know, there's this federal relief money that's coming down, whether it's ARPA funds or otherwise CARES Act funds, and they're coming down, but they're one-time funds. It helps in the short term, but what the state needs is recurring investments. And what taxpayers tend to be concerned about is, you know, is this going to come out of my income also? So It's important for people to know that this is not something that amounts to essentially a tax increase for them. It comes out of the already existing land grant permanent fund. It provides recurring funds every year. And that means that those funds continue to go into early childhood, regardless of who happens to be in political power. So when we change governors, when we have elections and legislators change, it's not something that can be changed on the whim of one person. So it's a concentrated strategic effort. There's been a lot of thought and work put into this and advocacy for years and years and years. And when there's polls done of New Mexicans, the polls show people are pretty overwhelmingly in favor of it.
Lori Martinez is Executive Director of Engage New Mexico. Thank you so much for joining us for the program.
Thanks for having me.
You can watch my full interview with Lori Martinez on Fronteras at Changing America tomorrow morning at 11:30. It is also online at our website, krwg.org. Let's go now to a local viewpoint. Rules on COVID-19 work protocols have Doñana County Sheriff Kim Stewart and County Manager Fernando Macias in a public disagreement. This isn't the first time a sheriff in the county and a county manager have clashed. Commentator Walt Rubel shares his thoughts in this week's commentary.
Back in the days when former Sheriff Kiki Vigil was constantly fighting with former County Manager Julia Brown, I thought it was just a personality clash between two strong-willed leaders acting a little bit like children. But now that current Sheriff Kim Stewart is constantly fighting with current County Manager Fernando Macias, I'm starting to think that this isn't just about personalities and that conflict is baked into the system. The latest clash involves the county manager's back-to-work edict. Macias has demanded that sheriff's officers be treated just like all other county employees and return to working from the office. During a recent press conference, Stewart argued that law enforcement officers are not like other county employees. She said her deputies have responded to 5 COVID-19 deaths in just the last few weeks, exposing them to the virus. She said 17 of her officers have tested positive since October 31st. It should be obvious that the consequences of a widespread outbreak in the sheriff's office or fire department would be much more dire than if one were to occur in the county accounting department. County rules would appear to give the county manager authority to tell the sheriff how to run that office, and they clearly give the county commission the authority to deny adequate funding for the office. That's a problem. When Vigil first came into office, he was justifiably outraged at the shoddy, broken-down equipment he inherited. Patrol cars with more than 250,000 miles on them, and radios that could only work in some parts of the county. Stewart has clashed with Macias since her first day in office. In 2019, she filed a complaint against Macias alleging violations of the Equal Employment Opportunity Act. The sheriff is elected by a full vote of all county residents in what is typically one of the most well-covered and closely followed of all the county races. County commissioners are only elected by the residents in their districts, and the county manager isn't elected at all. Our current system gives all the power to those who are least directly accountable to the voters. Voters expect the sheriff to be a well-trained law enforcement officer who has experienced the challenges that deputies face while on patrol, understands the different needs of each community and neighborhood in the county, and is well-versed on the latest trends and reforms taking place throughout the country. And they expect the sheriff to be able to do the job without meddling from those who are not trained in law enforcement. The county commission can fix this. They need to rein in the county manager and let the sheriff do her job. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG Public Media or NMSU. In Texas, the Democratic Party's hold on the Rio Grande Valley was seen until recently as a given. But that's changed since the 2020 presidential election. The city of McAllen elected its first Republican mayor in years. A Starr County state representative switched to the Republican Party, And some establishment Democrats aren't running for re-election, or they're leaving their district due to redistricting. Texas Public Radio's Gage Davila reports that this has opened up a power vacuum in the Rio Grande Valley.
The adage of Latino Americans always voting Democrat, particularly in the Rio Grande Valley, isn't true anymore. It may never have been. Dr. Monica Clua, a global political economy professor at the University of Texas at Rio Grande Valley, says upcoming elections could prove this.
What happens here really becomes a test case of whether Latinos will always be Democrats or not. And what's happening here is demonstrating that no, they might not always be Democrats. And in fact, they've got as much kind of political plurality as anybody else might have.
The top leadership of Texas is watching the RGV too. Texas Governor Greg Abbott is visiting the area more frequently, now with a serious challenge from former El Paso Congressman Beto O'Rourke. Abbott's campaign focus seems to be on the border. He revealed the state's plan to construct its own border wall at a press conference in Rio Grande City in December.
Texas is taking what truly is unprecedented action by any state ever for a state to build a wall on our border to secure and safeguard the sovereignty of the United States as well as our own state.
Some of O'Rourke's first campaign stops were in Hidalgo and Cameron County. He spoke with local school board members, mayors, and held rallies that attracted the same large crowds from his U.S. Senate and presidential runs. O'Rourke told TPR on November 17th, after a campaign rally in McAllen, that he's focusing on getting more voter turnout in the RGV.
There are 7 million eligible voters who didn't participate in last year's election. They're here in these communities. So by coming here early and coming back often and making sure that we don't just have great events like the one that we've had here tonight at the Gremlin in Hidalgo County, but that we also go door to door, as I'm asking everybody to do.
But the slate of progressive candidates on the ballot next year shows that residents want to see progressive policies in the RGV. Sarah Stapleton Barreta and Jessica Cisneros' campaigns in 2020 showed that in stride. The two young progressive attorneys nearly beat establishment Democrats Eddie Lucio Jr. and Henry Cuellar from the seats they've held for years. Both women are running again. That progressive wave wasn't a fluke either, says Jacqueline Arias, Lupe's community aid organizer.
The right is trying to paint this narrative that we're sick and tired of Democrats not doing anything. They're turning to the Republican Party. But, I mean, the Democratic leaders down here are extremely conservative. You know, they're pro-life and don't support raising the minimum wage.
Arias says some progressive causes, like health care access, higher wages, and a federal jobs guarantee, can reach across party lines, particularly for RGV residents, many of whom are still suffering financially from the COVID-19 pandemic.
You know, South Texas voters aren't monolithic. They want someone who will actually represent them on issues. And so like, they're not that Democratic stronghold. Like, they're not loyal to a party if they're not delivering on issues.
RGV Republicans are also disenchanted by Democratic leadership. But to the GOP, it's because Democrats have had power for too long.
Historically, yes, it's been a Democrat down here, and we've been voting one specific way. But throughout the years, not just me, have been bullied by our own people.
Adrian Peña Garza is the Hidalgo County GOP chair. She spoke to TPR in October about the RGV's shift to the right.
Because we've either been let down by a politician, or we've been let down by our government, or we've been let down by other people. You want to learn about the issue and then figure it out for yourself.
The RGV's political compass is being pulled on both ends of the spectrum. The RGV's political leadership will undoubtedly change this year. How much it will change is still up for speculation. Dr. Clua isn't sure where it might lead either.
We're going through a period where it's almost like an earthquake type of period. And so, you know, a lot of change and very rapidly happening change. And that, you know, that means that the outcome might be better, might be worse, or might actually be the same. And I think to me, ultimately, it's the openness of the moment. And having an open-ended moment is not necessarily a bad thing. It's actually the biggest opportunity for change the RGV has seen in a generation.
Texas's primary election is on March 1st, 2022. I'm Gage Davila in Port Isabel.
Hunger in the military has been a problem for decades. Low-ranking service members have too little food and limited options. The problem was complicated by the pandemic when military spouses lost jobs or family members got sick. 20% of active duty respondents to a survey this year say they experienced food insecurity, and more than 10% experienced hunger. In mid-December, Congress passed a spending bill with additional pay for tens of thousands of families struggling to feed themselves. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports that while that is progress, it isn't clear it will be enough.
Soon after getting married, Tabitha Lamb and her husband, a second lieutenant in the Army, were moved to a base in Minot, North Dakota. The move was challenging, not just because it started snowing in September and didn't stop, but because the two college graduates had to start paying back loans, and his first paychecks in the new assignment were correct. They were too low for his rank. By Christmas, they were feeling the crunch.
There were a few times we got really, really nervous. I did not go to the food pantry at that point because he was an officer and I was really frowned upon.
Rather than ask for help, the two racked up $5,000 in credit card debt. Lamb's father was in the Air Force, and they often struggled early in his career, but she says the attitude in the military has always been, if you can't make the ends meet, you aren't being responsible.
My God, my dad was working freaking three jobs on top of being in the military. It's just that there's not enough income coming in.
Decades after Minot, she says that stigma's still there.
Right about there. Thank you, ma'am.
She sees it on the faces of active duty service members when she volunteers at mass food distributions with the San Antonio Food Bank. Like this one at Fort Sam Houston, near downtown.
Celery, sweet potatoes, squash. What are the vegetables over there?
We also have broccoli.
Regular potatoes.
Okay.
Members of U.S. Army North bag up produce and quickly pack them into the trunks and truck beds of a long line of cars.
You're all set.
Wife and husband Angela and Andy Thompson sit in a line in their neon green Kia Soul. Angela has cancer, which has put an extra burden on their income. Andy is an active duty Army specialist.
The pay is sufficient to care for me and my family in completely normal circumstances. Add anything complicated to it, and there's a little bits here and there that, you know, come up short.
Most people NPR spoke with in this line did not want to be identified, like this woman. Her husband and she are both veterans. They use food pantries often throughout their time in service. And now with an injury making her husband's caregiver along with their two children, they need the help more than ever.
I don't want people to realize that I have to ask for help. Like, I'm a mom that can't provide everything I can for my kids. Sucks. And everybody on the outside always thinks that we can take care of ourselves, and sometimes we can't.
That's a common thing. I remember when we first started doing this, people didn't even want to roll the windows down to even speak to us.
Christine Abraham was an Army dietitian for 28 years and now runs the culinary wellness program on the base. The pandemic highlighted hunger to the nation, but she says when they started this on-base distribution a year ago, not everyone understood the need.
I've seen a lot of angry people when it comes to that food insecurity is not a problem. People angry that we're doing this. That wasn't a problem when I was active duty. I'm like, I don't know what rank you might have been, but it's a problem. It's always been a problem.
She says this on-base distribution puts the problem on display and hopes it helps to normalize people asking for help. Today, 250 households will go home with food.
My fear is to turn people away. That hurts. I mean, you want the food to go to those families that need it. The idea that we won't have enough, that hurts.
There are still barriers to military members accessing other federal food aid programs like SNAP, Abraham says. But glancing furtively at the line of cars, she's just worried about feeding this line of people today. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
Thank you for joining us for KRWG News this week. I'm Anthony Renault. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Remember, you can always keep updated with the latest news at krwg.org. Stay safe.